Hannah, you have eaten, tasted, digesting. Your thoughts, what did it taste like? Mm.
What you're hearing right now is the world's first taste test of a lab-grown hamburger. That means it's grown in a petri dish using cells from a real cow, but without killing any animals.
But there's quite some intense taste. It's close to meat. It's not that juicy.
Only three people got to try that first burger back in 2013. But right now, researchers all over the world are in a race to make cultured meat that tastes just like the stuff we're used to and costs about the same amount, too. Science reporter Marta Zaraska says we're only a couple years away.
It sounds very science fiction-like, but in reality, you know, these are just cells. There is nothing Frankenstein-y about it, you know. Many people worry, you know, what are those weird cells? But these are just basically cells like any other cells found in meat.
Because the way that I picture this, I remember when I was a kid getting tested for strep throat if I had a sore throat. And they would stick a cotton swabs down your throat and kind of gag you, and they would have this little plastic circle with this red stuff in it, and they would take the cotton swabs and mix them around in the red stuff. And then I guess if something grew in there, that meant you had strep throat. And what I'm picturing is they're basically like taking these cotton swabs and putting them into a cow, and then they swab them around the petri dish, and then a burger grows.
Actually, you are not that much off.
That's not the only futuristic burger they got in the pipeline, okay? Imagine one made entirely of plants that tastes exactly like a beef burger. It even bleeds. It's coming sooner than you think. Today on The Sporkful, we'll do a deep dive on the science of all of it, and we'll learn how to make a blended burger. That's when you put other stuff in the burger, so you use less meat, but it's still really delicious. In fact, sometimes it's even better. And I'll talk with Chef Tyler Cord, who's known for his vegetarian sandwiches, and especially for his love of broccoli. He's got a new cookbook out. We'll discuss the ideas he had for it that his publisher rejected.
I wanted to have all these photos of people dressed up like broccoli punching dogs in the face and stuff like that.
You wanted to make a normal cookbook.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Exactly.
What would a picture of a person in a broccoli costume punching a dog have conveyed?
Just how much I like broccoli.
That's coming up. Stick around. From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. Quick note to our friends in Chicago, we're returning to the Taste of Chicago for another live taping of The Sporkful. Guests will include Snap Judgment host Glenn Washington. It's Saturday, July 9th, 1 p.m. at the podcast tent. See you there. Now, let's get into this, okay? And let me start by throwing a couple facts out there for you. Back in the early 1800s, the average person here on planet Earth ate about 22 pounds of meat per year. In 2013, it was 95 pounds. For Americans, it's a lot more. Not only are we each eating more meat, but obviously there are a lot more people around than there were back then. So in order to make all this meat, we've had to do things that are bad for the animals, bad for the environment, and bad for our health. Let me throw one more fact your way. You got to feed a cow 13 pounds of cow food to get it to produce 1 pound of meat for us humans to eat. I say us humans because I assume that dogs aren't listening. Anyway, 13 pounds of food go into the cow, we get 1 pound of food back. It just doesn't add up, okay? It's not sustainable. So what can we do? Well, in a minute, we'll get to the futuristic stuff. But actually, there's something you can do right now at your next barbecue that's really delicious. It's called a blended burger.
We use Angus beef. We are just going to just chop some portobello, which we use in our burger. After they have been cooked in, we just literally massage it in and then make a patty with it.
This is Chef Jahangir Mehta. We're in the kitchen at his restaurant Graffiti in New York, and he's making me his signature Graffiti burger. About 25% of it is mushrooms and other herbs and spices, hence the term blended burger. It's kind of like the hybrid car of burgers, so it uses less beef, which is good for all the reasons that I talked about. But that's not why he does it. In fact, on the menu, it just says Graffiti burger, no mention of the mushrooms.
You don't think it's different? is just there. We've never viewed ourselves as how this whole trend is, oh, veg-centric restaurants. And then we never call ourselves that. This is our food and this is what we do. So basically, that's why we call it a graffiti burger, is because, and the restaurant graffiti too, because it is just my style of food. If people ask me, what is that? That's my style of food.
Some of that style comes from growing up in Mumbai. Some of it comes from training at the great French restaurant Jean Georges. Jahangir describes his cooking as a white lady wearing an Indian sari. He makes small burger patties. They're actually like mini burgers. And he seasons them almost sort of like the lamb kebabs you'd see on the streets of Mumbai. Garlic, onion, cilantro, turmeric, cumin, coriander, chili powder. I mean, the works. And then onto the griddle.
So we cook it about to medium rare. Again, if someone wants it differently, we are always willing to do it differently. But
if someone orders it and they say, I want it well done, doesn't that make you a little bit sad?
No, I have always been in the belief that if you like it that way, then why should we be the one judging you? Because your palate enjoys it that way. I think this is one thing I learned from, this was years ago, I worked for Jean Georges when we had first opened Jean Georges as a restaurant. And at that time, smoking was allowed at the bar. And one day I heard his executive chef saying that I can't believe they're doing this 9-course tasting menu with this amazing bottle of wine that they have bought for like, I don't know, 4,000, 5,000. And they keep smoking the whole time, every course. They can't even taste anything. And I heard Jean Georges repeat and say, well, if that is how they enjoy their meal, so be it. They like that palate of that smoky aspects of cancer. That's their point. But not me.
Jahangir puts the small burger on a grilled mini bun, and he tops it with lettuce, red onion, and fried enoki mushrooms.
One thing I have to say, I never understood how Americans can open their mouth so large to put in anything. Like when I first came, I could not believe how you can eat some of the things over here. And so I think this is the largest, I think, a 2.5-ounce patty is the largest I can open my mouth. So that's why we have it at 2.5 ounces. That was the architecture
right,
of it.
So for function over form.
Function over form. Though I am American, I'm very proud of it, but I've still not mastered that aspect. It was not a question
on the citizenship test. Well, I'll have to call the citizenship office
about
that. Yeah,
you should, definitely. Or a cat sandwich or something like that with a 1/2 pound or 1 pound of meat or whatever they put.
Should we eat?
Absolutely.
All right. Oh, man. It's so good. The crunchy mushrooms on top. I mean, I know it's not your goal to trick people, but if you wanted to trick people and tell people that it was a full beef burger, I would definitely believe you. It's really, really nice.
Yeah, I think because we put so many spices and herbs in it, and we also call it a kebab burger, it's like a style of a kebab, and people actually think it's made with lamb. And I think if we were in some third world country, we could have just said yes to it and made more money on it. But we like to be a little more honest here, I think, in this country.
That's not going to get you very far. That's Chef Jahangir Mehta. His restaurants in New York are Graffiti and Metaphor. And he was nice enough to share the recipe for his graffiti burger. We'll put it on Sporkful.com in the post for this episode. Also, if you want to find a great blended burger near you, the James Beard Foundation is doing a big event this summer called the Blended Burger Project. They got over 300 restaurants around the country taking part, from the Wandering Table in Spokane, Washington, to 11 Restaurant in Bentonville, Arkansas, to the Manor Tavern in Moncton, Maryland. And in each place, it's that chef doing their spin on a blended burger. We'll link to the full list of restaurants at Sporkful.com. Look for it in the post for this episode. Coming up, a deep dive into the science behind the meat of the future. How long till we can get some Stegosaurus burgers up in here? Plus, Chef Tyler Cord talks about his famous broccoli sub and other amazing vegetarian sandwiches. Stick around.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. Quick reminder that it's Podcast Appreciation Month, you guys. Support The Sporkful now, donate any amount, and you'll get 3 top secret episodes that are not publicly available, just for you. Give now at sporkful.com/donate or send a text. Text SPORK to 69866. Thanks. So the research being done on the meat of the future basically breaks down into 2 categories. First, you've got plant-based meat. So technically, it's not meat, but this is not your grandma's frozen veggie burger. This is stuff made from plants, but that totally passes for meat. Then there's the lab-grown meat that we talked about earlier. That is actual meat, but it's grown in a lab without killing any animals. Marta Zaraska has been following all this research for a really long time. She's a science reporter and author of Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. She joined me from her home in Paris, and I kicked it off with the most obvious question. And how long before the meat that's growing in the Petri dish eventually morphs into some sort of uber cow that takes over civilization as we know it?
I don't think that's going to be an uber cow, you know. I don't think that we'll have actually something that looks and moves, you know, and can be petted that's lab grown.
All right, so that's not a concern.
No, it's going to be more of, you know, huge vats or bioreactors full of cells. And that's actually very near in the future. So the producers of this kind of cultured meat say that in about 3 to 5 years, we can start seeing, for now, extremely expensive meats like that on the shelves of very upscale supermarkets and restaurants. For example, in places like the Middle East, you know, think of some fancy restaurant in Dubai.
So meat grown separate from an animal will be available in 3 to 5 years. But you said it's going to be really expensive. Why is it going to be so expensive?
The reason why it's so expensive is because, you know, there is lots of research required still. So lots of R&D, and also the problem is the nutrients for the cells, something called the growth medium. These are the nutrients, the soup of nutrients in which the cells are being grown. For now, this growth medium is the same as being used for medical reasons. And in medicine, you use very little of it. So it's been very expensive for a very long time. But to grow meat, you need huge quantities of that. So they are trying to figure out what else can be fed to those cells. But, you know, the price is really going down already. When you think about the price that, you know, the scientists had to pay to make the burger that was fried in 2013 in London, it costed, I think, $250,000 early this year. Another company has fried a meatball, and the price was, I think, $18,000 per pound. So it's still extremely expensive, but it's much, much less expensive than just 3 years ago.
And in 2013, when the first cultured meat burger was unveiled in London, you were there, right? I know you didn't taste it, but you smelled it. You talked to one of the women who tasted it. What was your opinion of it? What was the verdict?
So yeah, I was there. I was really hoping for some crumbs, but unfortunately, you know, I'm guessing even one single crumb would have costed like $5,000. So they weren't giving nothing to journalists, I'm afraid. But we could use our noses and smell the thing. And it did smell, you know, just like any frying meat. Those who were lucky enough to have tasted it said it tasted almost like a burger. So one thing that was missing in that burger in 2013 was fat, because back then they still didn't know how to grow fat cells. They're working on it right now as we speak. They're growing those fat cells, so they'll be able to add them.
And could this technology, like, could we Jurassic Park this at some point? Like, could we grow meat from extinct animals using this technology?
As long as you can get stem cells of them, you know, if you find some really well-preserved mammoth in, you know, in somewhere deep in Siberia, then I'm pretty sure it's doable. And, you know, the same thing with endangered species. You can eat any species you want as long as you take a small biopsy from a living animal.
So let's segue now to the other sort of major area of research, which is plant-based meat. And now we're using meat really in quotations because it's not meat. It's entirely, these are basically veggie burgers that taste like beef burgers. Can you give me a little lay of the land? Like, what are different people trying out there with this? What seems to be working? What do you think is the first thing we're going to see?
So it's already out there, you know, and some of those products are really amazing. You know, I've tasted some beef in the Netherlands made by a company called The Vegetarian Butcher, and their beef was so realistic, so beefy, that actually I didn't like it because I don't eat beef anymore. And the same, you know, I ate their bacon. I actually crave still bacon a lot. And it was amazing. You know, it didn't look very much like bacon, but once it was in your mouth, I couldn't taste any difference. Maybe if you are, you know, some very highly skilled food critic or something like that, maybe you would have detected the difference, but I was incapable of that. So
And the vegetarian butcher, the one in the Netherlands you mentioned, they made chicken that fooled the famous chef Ferran Adria. He guessed it was chicken thigh from the south of France, and it was completely vegetarian. So with these various meat substitutes, the newer ones, the really good ones, what are they actually made of? What's in these things?
They have lots of different vegetables and grains in them, very often fermented. So, for example, fermented wheat or lupin beans, they are very popular as well. And even things like carrots or onions, and just in different proportions. And basically what happens is that the protein gets broken down. Imagine you have a necklace. So necklace made of different amino acids that makes a protein. And you break this necklace. So all these little beds scatter. And then you just reassemble it into a different protein. For example, vegetarian butcher in Netherlands, they use machines that are basically the same machines you use for making things like pasta or cornflakes, breakfast cornflakes. They take this mixture of plant protein and they pass it through those machines and adjust you know, the temperature, the humidity and everything to make the texture as close as possible to real meat.
That it's like, it's amazing to me because there's so many things you need to replicate. It's not just about replicating raw meat. You also need it to react somewhat similarly to being cooked. And then it's the texture and it's the outside, the crust and the inside and the juice and even the color matters. Like, people want that same experience. Like, what are some of the biggest challenges they're butting up against?
So definitely the big challenge in the future would be to make an actual steak, for example, because it's much easier to make a burger, something that's, you know, minced meat. But an actual structure of a steak, a cut, a whole big cut of meat, that's very difficult because you have to replicate, you know, all these little veins, for example, in a steak. And this is something that's probably doable, but is much, much more complicated and difficult than just a simple burger or a meatball.
That's Marta Zaraska. Her book is Meat Hooked, The History and Science of Our 2.5 Million Year Obsession with Meat. Quick clarification. That first lab-grown burger cost 250,000 British pounds, so actually about 350,000 US dollars at that time. The lab-grown meatball that Marta mentioned, that was made by a company called Memphis Meats. You can check out a video of the meatball on their website. As for the plant-based meats, the Dutch company that Marta mentioned, the vegetarian butcher, they don't sell in the U.S. yet, but they do have a few stores around the world. Here in the U.S., there's a company called Beyond Meat. Actually, Bill Gates is an investor, and they're debuting their plant-based burger this summer. It's called the Beyond Burger, and it's made mostly of pea protein, yeast extract, and coconut oil, and it uses beet juice for the color. The L.A. Times did a taste test, and they said it sizzles when you put it on the grill, it browns on the outside and stays pink inside, and it really bleeds when you put it on a bun. As for the taste, they said it's about the same as standard supermarket beef. It doesn't have the depth of flavor or the caramelization that you get with a really good burger. But, I mean, it's progress. As Alton Brown put it, it's more like meat than anything I've ever seen that wasn't meat. Now, a lot of the concerns about meat that have led up to all this research are also a big part of a new book by Chef Tyler Cord called A Super Upsetting Cookbook About Sandwiches. It's got recipes for vegetarian and meat-filled sandwiches, and, well, it's uniquely Tyler, okay? Even without the broccoli punching the dog. The book's upsetting in part because Tyler talks a lot about the problems with eating meat. That being said, he still eats it. At least sometimes.
If everybody could just eat less meat, then maybe we wouldn't all have to stop eating meat at some point. You know, and maybe we won't. Maybe they'll figure out how to clone it or, you know, I don't know. Maybe they'll find a way to, maybe they'll find tuna on another planet and they can bring it here. But
I'll bet it'll be high in mercury.
Oh, yes. Good one.
Thanks.
But yeah,
that's the end of the interview. That's all we need.
Thank you so much for having me. My point is not isn't necessarily that we should, that everybody on the planet should be vegetarian, although I think it'd be lovely, but like, because I don't want to kill any more cow. I personally don't want to kill a cow. But barring that, I guess if everybody just at least thinks about it more, which I think in talking to my sister about the recipe testing, she was like, oh, these recipes are great. The only thing is like now when I go to the grocery store, I have a hard time buying some things because now I can't stop thinking about it. And I'm like, great, that's kind of the point. It's not like, you know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't ever go to Taco Bell again, but I think, you know, you should think about it so that it is more special, so that maybe you do it less often and it's more exciting. And does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I've tried to do the same thing in my own life. I try now to only have, to not have meat at lunch and dinner.
Sure.
In any given day. Like, not that I always did in the past, but now I try to really make a point of like having a vegetarian meal for one of those. I mean, I don't typically eat meat for breakfast.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, and then sometimes I won't eat any meat. But yeah, like you say, just to be more aware of it. Your broccoli sandwich remains like one of my all-time favorite sandwiches.
Thanks.
And I'm curious, like one of the first things that when I tell people that there's an amazing broccoli sandwich out there, it's like it breaks their brain.
Yeah.
Almost partly it breaks their brain on a structural engineering level. Like, but how do you put broccoli into a sandwich?
Right.
What do you say to that?
That's so stupid. Like, what does that mean? It's a sandwich. The whole idea is you have two things holding everything together.
But I do feel like, you know, that was one of my concerns going in. And I do think that with the wrong bread.
Yeah, but you're obsessed with the structural integrity of things. Maybe the broccoli is all going to fall out of your sandwich. And then you have to take a fork and then you have to eat that broccoli. That's not going to happen. But even if that did happen, so what? It's awesome. It's delicious. It's food. If, like, everything you put on that plate or in that bag or, like, wrapped in paper is awesome, like, who cares? Get over it. I'm sorry. I'm kidding because I know that you can't get over it.
No. I take your point. All I'm thinking about is that I feel like there's this sort of interesting contrast between, like, a lot of your approach to food is, like, people think this matters and it doesn't matter. People say that this is a rule. These things don't go together, but they do go together. You do whatever you want. You know, make whatever mayo you want. Combine whatever ingredients you want.
Right.
But, like, I don't get the impression that that's really your personality.
Huh.
Like, your personality isn't actually, like, whatever. Do whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. I don't care.
I really like food. I guess it's making it harder to be a chef, too. Like, the longer I do this for a living and the more I think about it and the more I experience new foods and I have these preconceived things that I say, I don't like green peppers, so then I don't eat green peppers for 2 years, and then when I do, I'm like, whoa, green peppers are awesome. That's a flavor I have, like, I forgot how good that could be. I'm learning that I like everything. And again, that makes it kind of tough to be a chef and maybe tough to write a cookbook because it's, I like everything tastes good. I say it to my wife all the time. Food tastes good. Maybe that's the title of my next book. But
food tastes good.
Like,
let's talk about this asparagus sandwich, which has asparagus, roasted tomato, mayo, lime, and fried garlic, and you serve it on a griddled hot dog bun, like a New England style lobster roll situation.
Right.
It looks amazing, and I have asparagus in my fridge right now, so I might make this very soon.
Good.
But you talk in the recipe here about your frustrations with people who, and chefs and cookbooks that insist on you using only the finest ingredients.
Sure.
Why shouldn't we use only the finest ingredients?
Well, I don't know. What's fun? Where's the challenge in that? That's not that fun. And again, like, what happens to all the other ingredients? There's lots of food in the world. What are you doing with the stuff that's not the best? We have cookbooks there are like a gajillion cookbooks out there, and they probably, a lot of them can probably tell you how to make asparagus taste better if it's not like the freshest, most perfect asparagus you've ever seen. So it just seems weird that that's something that chefs say all the time. And especially for like a restaurant chef, that's kind of a lie. Like at a restaurant, you're not trying to buy the best ingredients possible. I mean, like maybe one or two restaurants are. Like I bet Per Se is trying to buy the very best ingredients they possibly can. But for like a normal neighborhood restaurant, when people come in and they say, is this cheese pasteurized? And I say, well, am I charging you $30 for it? Like, of course it's pasteurized because the unpasteurized stuff is expensive as heck.
And you are a big proponent. In fact, you had a big impact on me getting more into eating the stalks of a head of broccoli.
Sure, it's delicious.
The stalk, is that what you call the stem, the trunk part?
Yeah, sure.
You know, like,
but it's not the best, it's not the best, freshest part of the, like, it's not the, like, yeah, it's not the prime real estate.
But I, you know,
but it's awesome.
I trim down the, you know, I take the peeler to it or just a knife and just trim off the especially tough outside. I slice it up like you told me, throw that in. You know what I've been doing? I take the broccoli, and this isn't exactly vegetarian anymore. I melt down the duck fat and I add some Maggi sauce, which is like MSG, yeah, salt and sugar, basically, and mix that with the duck fat. And I coat that on the broccoli and I roast it for 10 minutes at like 450. And those slices of the trunk are like, they get really crunchy and salty and fatty. I mean, yeah, they're like chips. I mean, they're like broccoli chips. They are so good.
That sounds delicious.
You do put some ingredients into sandwiches that people may be surprised to hear as the featured ingredients or as components of sandwiches. Grape jelly mayo.
Yeah.
What do you, I mean, like, that's going to sound strange to people, but it sounds also amazing.
And it's great.
It's not too sweet. How do you make it?
It's sweet. I mean, but it's not any sweeter than, like, a Russian dressing or anything that you've mixed ketchup and mayo together in. Sometimes I admittedly apply some weird theory. Like, I make my own rationale for these really weird-sounding things that admittedly doesn't actually have any true grounding in reality. But so that's maybe one of them, because I was thinking about how, like, well, grapes are in many ways kind of the most universal of all fruit, because we make wine out of grapes and everybody likes to drink wine with literally every cuisine that there is. So that to me means that grape jelly can be put into any dish that exists. If you can drink wine with it, you can put grape jelly on it, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, it started with that notion, so I put it in mayonnaise and put it on a sandwich and it was awesome. I think we first did it on like a braised short rib sandwich. Anyway, if you pair it with something that's salty, it just adds some awesome sweetness to it.
So for people out there who are going to hear about a sandwich where the featured ingredient in the sandwich is broccoli or sweet potatoes or asparagus or something that may sound different from what they're used to, mm-hmm, what do you say to them, sell them on the idea of a sandwich with broccoli or sweet potatoes or asparagus as the featured ingredient?
I mean, I shouldn't have to. Like, grow up. Right? I mean, a plate of spaghetti with tomato sauce is perfect. A slice of cheese pizza is perfect. And you don't say, like, but where's the big slab of meat? You know, like, that's ludicrous. It's just stupid. And I will not justify it with, well, I guess I already did. But that's all I have to say about that. Make a sandwich. Get over it.
That's Chef Tyler Cord. His new book is called A Super Upsetting Cookbook About Sandwiches. I promise you this, it is not like any other cookbook out there. In fact, here's Tyler reading an excerpt.
Add the chipotles, pecans, tahini, dark chocolate, vinegar, maple syrup, and salt. Increase the heat to medium-low and continue cooking, stirring occasionally until your apartment smells awesome and people stop texting you trying to get you to do things you don't want to do. People will literally always want you to do things you don't want to do, so just pour yourself a drink, put your phone on Do Not Disturb, and then smash it with a medium sauté pan, being careful not to get bits of metal and plastic into the sauce until completely obliterated. 1 to 3 minutes.
The book comes out next week. Pre-order it now wherever you get your books. And also, we'll post the recipe for Tyler's broccoli sub on our website. It's got pickled lychees in there and a dry, salty cheese called ricotta salata. It's just so good. Tyler, you may know, is also the man behind Number 7 Restaurant and Number 7 Sub in New York. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Editing help from Shoshana Gold. Engineering help from Irene Trudell and Chase Culpin. Music help from Black Label Music. Special thanks to Paula Schumann. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Cindy Elder from Lincoln, Nebraska.
And this is Larkin from Ithaca, New York.
And this is Jeff Grossman from Redmond, Washington, saying, eat more,
eat better,
and eat more better.